on a function is simply the directional derivative, which is the application of the direction. We generalize the linear derivative to all differential forms. So now we know how to differentiate the differential form in an arbitrary direction given by a vector psi. Now let us address the question whether we can directionally differentiate arbitrary tensors, not just totally and asymmetric covariant ones. For that purpose, we will have to go back to a geometric definition. We managed to define the linear derivative algebraically as the anti-commutator of the inner derivative and the exterior derivative, as long as we were considering only differential forms. In order to generalize the notion of the directional derivative to all tensor fields, we will have to go back to this expression, to this limiting expression for derivatives of functions in this case. Remember that the key concept here is to evaluate the function at two points. At the point where we want to know the derivative, x, and also at a neighboring point, x plus epsilon. Take the difference between the two and divide by the distance, epsilon. Let the epsilon, the limit epsilon, go to zero. This works for functions line. We want to generalize this not only to functions on a manifold, but also to tensors on a manifold. There's going to be an additional complication, and that is the following. If this is a tensor at the point x, and this were to be a tensor at the point x plus epsilon, so this is one point of the manifold, that's another point of the manifold, then what are they? They live in a tensor space. This lives in a tensor space, in the tensor space that is attached to the point x. This tensor would live in a tensor space attached to the point x plus epsilon. But they are different tensor spaces. In the simplest case, it might be the cotangent space or the tangent space. Then this would be a vector. The function would be a vector in the tangent space at x. And this would be a vector in the tangent space at x plus epsilon. But we cannot add, or in this case, subtract two vectors that live in different vector spaces. They better live in the same vector space so that we can subtract it. So we will have to address this. How can we make an expression like this, but applicable to tensors? And the trick will be that we will use a map from the tensor space at the point x plus epsilon to the tensor space at x. Here's the geometric definition of the linear derivative. Well, not quite yet. I'm just still preparing for it. As I said, we will need a geometric approach. But just remember how the geometric approach to the directional derivative works. We considered path in the manifold. I think we lost the ground. There they are again. Consider gamma a path in the manifold. Concretely, this is a map from an interval in the real line into the manifold. It maps points on the real line, which you can think of as the time, if you wish, into points of the manifold. Then, for any such path that passes through the point in question, P, we may choose the parameter in such a way that as the parameter reaches the value T naught, the path is at the point P in question. Then we associate to the path a tangent vector, which we denote by gamma bar. And being a tangent vector, it ought to be a linear map of functions into the real numbers, such that the Lagrange rule is obeyed. Now, the tangent vector, in this sense, associated to a path, is defined to act on functions in the following way. The tangent vector maps the function into the action of the tangent vector onto the function. It's just giving a name. And explicitly, it is doing this. Take the path. At the path, at the point of the path, evaluate the function. And differentiate this function of phi at the time t naught where the path goes through the point p. This is simply, as we discussed before, the directional derivative of f in the direction of the path. Now, you can work this out with the chain rule, and then you will see how that is just what I said. We discussed that before. Now, a very important notion is that of an integral curve. The idea is simply the following. Let us assume we are given a vector field psi. You can think of it this way. You have the manifold, and on the manifold, at each point, you have a vector pointing somewhere. Think of this as being a velocity field, velocity of some gas. I'm saying gas rather than fluid, because when you think fluid, you might think of incompressible fluid. But for a gas, of course, you could imagine that there is compression, decompression happening. So in general, for a vector field, you have to allow for compressibility. Think of it, therefore, as the vector field psi as being something like a gas. And you have the local velocity of the gas molecules, or of the gas. Don't think of the molecules, just the gas as a fluid. As it goes along. So an integral curve to the vector field psi is a curve path gamma such that the tangent vector associated to the path agree with the vector field on the path. So an integral curve is a curve whose associated velocity is the vector field psi that's given. From the theory of ordinary differential equations, one can deduce that for every point of the manifold, there exists at least some finite infinitely differentiable integral curve to that point. Which is to say that if psi is a smooth vector field, then there is always a path that goes through the point P in question, and the path in a finite stretch before the point P, at the point P, and a finite stretch after the point P has a tangent vector which matches the field psi. Since we can do this at every point P of the manifold, it means that for every vector field psi, there is a bunch of integral curves, which at least for a finite amount of time, if we call this path parameter time, is for at least for a finite amount of time, a set of integral curves for that vector field.
For every p belonging to M, but also the psi in consideration?
Yes, you're given a vector field psi, and then I'm saying that there is a family of paths that cover the manifold that goes to all points such that the tangent vectors to the path are the vector field. This is what is called the flow. So we may choose the amount of time that we propagate those and this flow to be t. So it starts at t equals 0, and it runs until the value t is reached. Intuitively, you can think of it this way. If this is the manifold, which has some vector field psi on it, then choose a point, for example, this point here. From the theory of ordinary differential equations, we can deduce that there is a path going through on that point such that the tangent vectors to this path agree with the vector field psi. And if we follow that path until its parameter reaches the value t, starting from 0, then we end up at another point. Okay, so if we started at this point and then follow the path for a certain amount of its parameter, then we may end up at this point here. On the other hand, we may want to look at this point, then the flow takes it while the parameter runs from 0 to t to that point. Similarly, every other point of the manifold, every point of the manifold gets mapped to another point of the manifold along the flow. And the longer we flow, the further away are we mapping it. So this is going to be important because we are going to differentiate directionally. We want to differentiate tensor fields with respect to certain directions, which is to say we want to differentiate tensor fields with respect to a vector field, psi. You see, what the vector field does is it gives you at every point a direction. Or at every point, it gives you a tangent to a path. And this picture is a little bit messy because we have the start and the end points in the same picture. You can draw this like that, and the mathematics of it hopefully becomes a little bit clearer. Let's look at two copies of the same manifold N. Look at the point P. Then, let's say this is the point P. Then through this point, there is going to be a path whose tangent vectors agree with the vector field psi, and we run along this path until the parameter has increased from 0 to a certain value T. And we end up at another point here, which we may call phi of t. And that's, again, a point of the manifold. You see, this is the same manifold as that one. I just drew it twice. So this flow is really a diffeomorphism. It is an invertible, differentiable map from the manifold into itself. So from the manifold into itself. It's mapping this point into its image, a little bit further down the flow. So this is the key map here. Phi index t of t. Phi index t of t is the image of the point p under the flow up until the parameter value has increased from 0 to t.
No, not at all. It's not a parallel transform at all. Because we have not defined what it means, parallel.
It's not at all. It's just, you see, we're not even transporting tensors so far. We're just mapping a point into a point. If you already know about parallel transport, forget about it. We'll get to it. This has nothing to do with parallel transport. Lead derivatives have nothing to do with parallel transport. Very important to keep these things at distinct. Okay, so on one hand, you now understand that the flow induced by a vector field is inducing a map of the manifold into itself, a point to a point a little later. This is the key map that will replace the following. Remember this expression for the derivative. One important thing that we will need is, if we want to differentiate the derivative at the point x, is also the point x plus epsilon, a little bit further away. And the vector field will tell us in which direction we have to go and which point we reach. And that is what this phi t is going to do for us. It maps the point p at which we want to differentiate into a neighboring point. And then, of course, we will have to evaluate. We will use the map phi t to map our point p into a neighboring point. And then we will have to evaluate the tensor at this neighboring point and apply a map that maps this tensor into a tensor at the point in question so that we can take the difference between the two tensors. So this is one perspective to look at this, but there's another perspective to look at it, which is going back to how we started this whole business of differential geometry. Here's a manifold, there's a manifold, we have a diffeomorphism between them, and that induces all sorts of maps. If you remember, if we have a diffeomorphism from one manifold into the other manifold, that means in particular that if we have a function germ over here, it actually gets mapped into a function germ over there. How is that? Well, if here's a function germ, we can always concatenate it and view it as a function germ over here simply by saying that, well, we feed it numbers here, they get mapped into that and then into the function germ. Therefore, a function germ here is always also a function germ over there. But that, in turn, if you remember, induces a map from the tangent space here into the tangent space there. Okay? Because tangent vectors were acting on function germs. And then we also had maps the same way between the cotangent vectors and generally the tensor spaces. All those maps are invertible, so we have that we can go both ways. So that is the key trick now. Through the map phi t, we can achieve the x plus epsilon path. This part. Find a neighboring point. Simply follow the flow. And phi t is, as we just discussed, inducing a map of function germs into function germs, tensors into tensors. Tensors at one point into tensors at another point. That's what we will need. We will need this induced map to take the value of a tensor field over here at the other point and map that into a tensor at the same same tensor space as this tensor here, namely at the original point where we want to differentiate. Okay, so the point is that, as always, this diffeomorphism induces corresponding isomorphisms of the tangent space here to the tangent space over there, cotangent space here to the cotangent space over there, and all tensor spaces here get mapped into tensor spaces over there and vice versa, it's all invertible. This map, remember, is called phi t star. It's the map that maps R and S fold contra and covariant tensors in at the point P into R and S fold contra and covariant tensors at the point phi t, the image, under the flow in this case. And this map is invertible. It's an isomorphism.
Map, if phi t, it maps two points. So now the tangent vectors corresponding to the two points will be different.
If you have a tangent vector here, then this will map it into a tangent vector there. It has nothing to do with what the field psi or any other field over there does, or what it does over here. This is a canonical map that takes tangent vectors here into tangent vectors there, and a tensor in this space becomes a tensor in that.
On the tangent.
It has nothing to do with the path in between. It's an important thing. See, I think you're still having in mind parallel transport. Not to do with this. You see, we are mapping here the point here
into that point. You're mapping this point into that point. You're mapping this point into that point. The fact that there is a path in between ultimately doesn't matter. We could have gone from this point to that point by another path. As long as this is the starting point and that is the ending point, the map phi is fixed. And therefore, the maps that it induces for the tensor field are also fixed. That's different from parallel transport later on, where the path will matter. Here it doesn't. The path only induces all those things for us. But once you have the map that gives you the flow from one point to another point at a finite time later, you can forget about what in the intermediate times happened.
Use the map.
Yes, it induces the map. But if you know the map, then you don't, you can't recover the path from.
So let us remember what a tensor field is. Let us call a tensor field tau. So don't mix this up with a time. Tau doesn't stand for time. Tau stands for a tensor field. Tau has and coordinates lots of coefficients and so on. It's a tensor field. What does it do? It gives you, for every point of the manifold, a tensor in the tensor space of that manifold. So the tensor field at the point is an element of this tensor space. Now we say, before we define the derivative, let's just say what we mean when we say that the tensor field is invariant or doesn't change under the flow induced by vector field psi. A notion that will be very important later on in general relativity when we discuss the notion of the conservation of momentum, angular momentum, energy, and so on. Because remember, by Noether's theorem, if something is invariant under some symmetry, then you get a conservation. So the Lie derivative will have an important application in this in this way. We say that the tensor field tau is invariant under the flow induced by a vector field psi if this equation holds. This equation, let's look at this equation. You take the point T and map it to another point of the manifold by using the flow from time t equals 0 to time t. So this is the image of the point t under the flow after the time t. At this image of the point t, where the point t flows to, we evaluate the tensor field. So this is the tensor field at the arrival point of the flow. This is the point of the manifold, the tensor field at the point of the manifold T, and then we use the induced map that comes with the flow to map that tensor field into a tensor field at the point tau, at the point phi T of T. Remember that phi star can be used to map tensors on the left-hand side manifold to tensors in the on the right-hand side manifold. So here we first map using the flow and then evaluate the tensor there. And here we first evaluate the tensor field at the point T, and then we map the resulting tensor into the tensor space at the remote point. If those two are the same, then you say that the tensor field hasn't changed. It doesn't matter whether you first evaluate what the tensor is here, and then use the flow map to look at it over there in the other tensor space, or you first flow to the other point and then evaluate the tensor field there. If you get the same thing both ways, you say that the field is invariant. Notice that there's no notion of parallel transport. Please clear your mind of this. So now that we know what it means that the field doesn't change, it's straightforward to define how much it changed if it does. We define the Lie derivative, according to its geometric definition, of any tensor field tau at the point P with respect to the flow induced by vector field psi in this way, just like in Newton's Leibniz limit. So the Lie derivative of the tensor field tau in the direction of psi at the point P, which could be an arbitrary point, that's why I didn't specify it, but you always have to assume we're looking at a particular point just to make things definite. This Lie derivative is defined by this right-hand side. Here we have the tensor field at the point P. And here we have the inverse. You see, this is pi star inverse. And that is the map that takes tensors from the faraway point where we flow to and maps them back into tensors in the point at the point P. So here we take the tensor field, evaluate it at the faraway point, and then use this induced map to have this tensor live in the tensor space at the point P. Therefore, this tensor lives in the same tensor space, namely the tensor space at the point P, as does this tensor, and therefore we can take the derivative of the two. They live in the same vector space, tensor space. And then we divide this derivative by T, take the limit for T going to zero, just as Leibniz and Newton did. Here's the same thing spelled out more explicitly. We put in the point P. The tensor field evaluated at the point P. This is a tensor living in the tensor space at the point P. Here, we take the tensor field at the point that we flow to, gamma of T. That is a point further down the road along the path. This is a tensor that lives in the wrong tensor space for what purposes. It lives in the tensor space attached to the faraway point. But applying this inverse map, inverse induced map, we can map this tensor into a tensor in the tangent space at P, in the tensor space attached to the point P. Therefore, both expressions live in the same tensor space. We can take the derivative, divide by T, take the limit. How does that look like explicitly in a chart? Let's say our map phi maps the point x into the point x tilde. We are only interested in the limit for infinitesimally small flow because of t going to zero. And in this case, things are relatively simple because we can already say that the coordinates of the points that we flow to are given by the coordinates of the points that we start at, point P, let's say. And then the new coordinates differ from the old coordinates by something linear because we're in the linear regime. We're just looking at what survives in the limit that we take over there. And it's clear that since we only have this T in the denominator, only the linear term will survive. So the new coordinates, the coordinate of the point that you flow through, differ from the old coordinate simply by something linear, namely t times psi I of x, and that linear thing, of course, has to be the tangent, has to be the vector field whose flow we use to differentiate. This is the direction in which we flow. Then let us calculate what the change of coordinate matrix is. So we calculate dx tilde by dx We get the Kronecker delta from the first term, and we get this from the second term, which is not trivial because the psi are not just constants. In general, this vector field will be dependent, on the position, and therefore there will be some non-trivial coefficient here. And we neglect the higher order term. The inverse of this Jacobian matrix is simply given by that. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with this, but try it out. If you take this matrix and multiply it with that matrix, contract over a common index, you get the identity matrix up to terms of order t squared. That's simply because if you multiply this with that, you get the product of the two Kronecker deltas, which gives you the identity, the Kronecker delta. The mixed terms go away because you have a plus b times a minus b, which is a squared minus b squared. So you only get the t squared term, but that is of order t squared. So this is the inverse of that up to order t squared. No matrix is easier to invert than one which you have only the linear order. Now that we know the Jacobian and its inverse, we know how to transform contravariant and covariant indices of tensors. Because we know that they transform simply with respect to this and that matrix. You see, all that the flow is a diffeomorphism. And we know how the coordinates of a tensor change under diffeomorphism. So the tau is changing its coordinate in this way. I'm already doing the inverse flow here. So it's the original matrix of our tensor field. And then we have all those inverse Jacobian matrices, namely those, for the contravariant indices. And we have those Jacobian matrices, this one, for the covariant indices. We already know what those matrices are through the order of interest. Namely, we can simply use those expressions, plug them in here, and we obtain that the tensor changes its coefficient in this way. So it is the original tensor plus terms linear in T. We are neglecting, after all the terms that would be quadratic in higher order in T. We get the original tensor here again because we get the product of all the Kronecker deltas. When we multiply all those Jacobian matrices, that gives us the original tensor. And then we get a contribution from each one of those matrices, one contribution from each one of those matrices. For example, this matrix here will give us a contribution from this term multiplied with the Kronecker delta of all the others. Can't be multiplied with one of those terms of the others because they would be of higher order in T. So we obtain that the image of the tensor is given by those expressions here, where we have pluses whenever we have the I'm missing one term here. this thing itself also needs to be expanded in T, right? And that is, of course, the original tensor, thus the original tensor differentiated with respect to an arbitrary coefficient, and then to all of the indices by the chain rule, and then contracted with the psi. And that is a term proportional to T as well. So we get the original term, the original tensor, that gives us this one, plus the terms that are proportional to T are the term that we get from Taylor expanding this term to the linear order. That gives us a term linear in T with the first derivative of tau. That's this term here, you see, differentiating tau with respect to K, and then contracting with the psi, simply by the chain rule. And then it gives us all those other terms here, where we get a minus sign whenever we had one of those, you know, we look at one of those Jacobian matrices, and gives us a plus sign whenever we look at one of those Jacobian matrices, depending on whether we had a contravariant or a covariant index. So this is, let me just show you what here, what we did in concretely. This is what we are calculating here in the definition of the Lie derivative. We take the tensor field and we calculate its value, and at a distant point, that's why we had x plus t tau, x plus t psi, that's what was in here. Then we obtain a value of tau, but then we had to use the inverse of the induced map to get it back into the tensor space at the point T. And this is the result that we obtain, this one.
Sorry.
This is the result that we obtain. So we have to take this minus the tensor field at the point P, and then take the limit for, divide by T, and take the limit for T going to zero. So the Lie derivative is the limit for T going to zero, 1 over T, the complicated expression that we just calculated above, minus the tensor field at the point in question. Remember that the tensor field itself was one of the terms up there. It was the first one, this term. So that term goes away, and all the rest contributes to the derivative. Namely, we get one term that came from the Taylor expansion of the tensor field in order to obtain the value of the tensor field at the faraway point. And we get all those negative terms for the contravariant indices, and all those positive terms for the covariant indices. So this is a key equation here. It tells us what is the directional derivative of an arbitrary tensor field in the direction of phi in coordinates. Now let's see, is this equivalent to how we define the Lie derivative algebraically for differential form? After all, differential forms are also tensor fields. In order to verify that we get the same thing, all we have to do is check that the Lie derivative, geometrically defined, does the proper job on zero form and on a basis of one form. Because we know that then it will be doing the right thing on all differential forms because of the Leibniz. So let us check in the case that the Lie derivative acts on a function, which is to say on a zero form. But in this case, the Lie derivative, according to the geometric definition up there, is what? Let's just quickly look at this again. this is the linear derivative of an arbitrary tensor field. Now consider the possibility that tau is a 0-0 tensor, which is to say it's a function. No indices whatsoever. In this case, the only term that survives is that one, because this one is associated with the contravariant indices, that is associated with the covariant indices, and that's the only one that survives. So what we have is tau, comma k, psi k. Oh, I hope I mentioned that before, that whenever we have twice occurring indices, we follow the Einstein summation convention. So all we have is tau, comma k, psi k. So we have tau, comma k, psi k. This is, written in another way, psi k d by dxk tau, which we recognize is the gradient. This is simply the directional derivative. This is, what is this? This is the action of the vector field psi on a function. It's simply differentiating that function in the direction of. We set out to generalize this very notion. So this is correct. The linear derivative, according to the geometric definition, is really giving us back the ordinary directional derivative of function. What do we have for a covector field, for a cotangent field? The cotangent field has one covariant index, the lower index. Cotangent field is always of this form, because we know that we can choose those dxj as a basis. Now, a covector field is also one form. According to the definition above, the lead derivative, or directional derivative in the direction of the vector field psi, of a one form, or of a cotangent vector field, is given by this first term, where we differentiate the tensor field, just as we did up here. So it's the comma k, and then contracting with the psi, plus one term, because we have a one-fold covariant tensor, which is the psi k differentiated with respect to the j, contracted with the tau k. Remember, this is just a special case of this expression here. The derivative of the cotangent vector field gives us this term and one of those terms, where we're differentiating the vector field according to which we're differentiating and contracting with the covariant index here. So this index is contracted with that one. And here we're differentiating. Okay, and something we have not yet shown is that this is indeed the expression that we get for differential form. We calculated a lot, but we haven't actually worked it out in coordinates what it is, and I'd like to leave it to you as an exercise to verify that this is also the expression we get if you calculate the lead derivative of the one form according to the algebraic definition. Let us collect, let's say, the properties of the lead derivative. So the lead derivative is a generalization of the notion of directional derivative. As such, it maps functions into functions, one forms into one forms, and indeed RS tensors into RS tensors. In particular, the lead derivative of a vector field, the lead derivative of the vector field eta in the direction of psi, so if eta as well is a vector field, is a tangent vector field, it's a contravariant vector field, then it can be shown that this lead derivative is indeed the commutator of the two vector fields. I just state this without proof. One also finds that the lead derivative in the direction of the sum of two vector fields is actually the sum of the two lead derivatives. You can try to get some intuition about this. And the lead derivative in the direction of the commutator of two vector fields is the commutator of the two lead derivatives. What about the Leibniz rule? We know that the lead derivative is a derivation on the Grassmann algebra of differential form, and it obeys a Leibniz rule with respect to the wedge product. Leibniz rule is a product rule. Now, a product with respect to which multiplication? The wedge product. We have just generalized the Lie derivative to tensor fields. They don't have a wedge product. Only differential forms have a wedge product. The tensor fields have another kind of product, namely a tensor product. And it turns out that the Lie derivative is indeed a derivation also with respect to the tensor product. But we will not further use the fact that tensors form an algebra with respect to multiplication using the tensor product. It's just nice to know that this is so. Finally, we are ready for integration. Let us remember why we gave differential forms a special treatment. After all, they're just tensors. Well, they're not just tensors. They are covariant tensors and totally anti-symmetric. And I promised something about integration. So the point is that because of their anti-symmetry and because they are covariant tensors, they and only those tensors are suitable to define integration. Let me show you how that works. First, we need a little preparation, which has to do with the notion of orientation. We need to know what is an oriented or what is an orientable manifold. Consider, for example, a one-dimensional manifold. Think of it as some sort of spaghetti floating in space. Let's say we want to integrate along this spaghetti. In practice, what we could do is we could map our spaghetti into a piece of the real line, into an interval of the real line. This is what a chart is. It takes points from our abstract manifold, in this case a one-dimensional manifold, and maps those points into points of Rn, in this case R. You see, there are two ways of doing this. I could map the start point P of the spaghetti into the lower end of the interval, and then the end point of the spaghetti into the upper end of the interval, and all the other points in between into points in between. Or I could do it the other way around. I could map the start point of the spaghetti into the upper end of the interval, and the other points accordingly. Then that probably gives me a minus sign, an overall minus sign in the integration. You see, just like in ordinary integration, when we change the integration limits, we actually pick up a minus sign, which is because when we do the chain rule, change from a variable t to a variable t prime, then we get a Jacobian dt by dt prime, which has the value minus 1. Generally, if we have a higher dimensional manifold here and we map it using a chart into Rn, into a piece of Rn, into a region or domain of Rn, then there may be two ways of doing it, or many ways of doing it, and there may be an overall minus sign in the Jacobian. And also, for higher dimensional manifolds, we may, in general, need several charts. There may not exist a single chart that maps the entire manifold into a region of Rn. We may need several charts. And then we need to worry about the relative signs of the Jacobians that come with the several charts. So a key definition, therefore, is to call a complete collection of charts an atlas. I think we had this definition before. A complete collection of charts is called an atlas, and this atlas is called oriented if among all the overlapping charts, somebody's working here with paper that we can hear that very loudly. Okay, thank you. The microphone is picking up too much now. Okay. So an atlas is called oriented if when you have two charts that overlap, the Jacobian that you get from changing charts, you see, whenever you have an overlap region where both charts are available, you can go from one coordinate system to the other coordinate system, same patch, and you describe you see two coordinate systems. And you get a Jacobian matrix, and you can ask, what about its determinant? If all those determinants are positive, all those change of chart determinants are positive, then you say that this atlas is orientable. A manifold is called orientable if it possesses an oriented atlas. For example, a Möbius strip is not orientable. So a manifold together with the choice of oriented atlas is called an oriented manifold. Then, since we, in general, will have to work with different charts, or it may also be just convenient sometimes to use a chart that is not part of this oriented atlas. You may want to choose an arbitrary chart sometimes. Then it is called a positive or negative chart if when you go from this atlas to this chart that we may want to choose occasionally, we get a positive or negative Jacobian as we do it. Just a bit of bookkeeping that has to do with left-handedness or right-handedness of coordinates. Okay, so now we are ready for the notion of integration. Remember what happens when you do an integration in Rn. This is the case that we have all done in calculus 3 or 4 or electrodynamics, for example. Let's say we change coordinates when we integrate in Rn. We change coordinates from coordinates xn to x tilde, x1 to xn. Then the original integral over Rn of a function g of x1 to xn becomes, under change of coordinates, an integral over Rn again. But now, remember, you also pick up this determinant, the Jacobian determinant. So you take, you can remember that easily. If here are the tilde coordinates, then here you have the Jacobian matrix, which has the x tilde in the denominator, so that you intuitively can cancel them against one another. So this is a determinant factor that keeps track of the fact that this coordinate system of the axis may be locally stretched or expanded or compressed or rotated against the coordinate system over there, so that a little parallelogram in this coordinate system may be a big or a small parallelogram with different angles over there. And that means that the volume of that little parallelogram may be different over here than over there. The determinant factor is exactly to compensate for that. If you didn't do this, of course, you could not expect that the integral in the new coordinates could give you the same answer as the integral in the old coordinates. The determinant, after all, is giving you the deformed volume of the parallelogram. So the key message we have to take away from this is that as we change coordinates, in Rn at least, we have to expect this determinant factor to make the integral come out right. Not only expect, we know that this is the right thing. Now, obviously, when we want to define integration on a generic abstract manifold, then we will follow the usual strategy of boiling things down to coordinates. So we will use a chart, several charts, map things from the abstract manifold into Rn, and then use usual Rn integration. But it has to be done in a consistent way. The answer cannot depend on which chart we use. Otherwise, it would be a funny kind of integration over the manifold when the outcome would depend on the coordinate system of the tube. It should really only depend on the manifold and the function or functions or tensors that live on it. So this should give us a hint as to how we can integrate. And it does. Let us look at the general differentiable manifold N and consider now an N form omega. So the manifold is assumed to be N dimensional, and we look at an N form. An N form, I hope you remember, always takes this form. We have dx1, veg dx2, veg dx3, etc., up to dxn. And you cannot have any other because these are anti-commutative. So if you had dx1, dx1, well, that's zero. So this is a basis vector in the space of n forms. The space of n forms is only one dimensional, and this is its basis vector. Of course, we could write this basis vector in a different way. For example, we could write here dx2, veg dx1. This would give us the same vector up to minus sign. And whenever we change any two of those, we pick up a minus sign. Okay, so an arbitrary n form is always a zero form, veg, all those one forms, where the veg is usually omitted because it's commutative. So it's just a function times this basis vector. Now, how does this thing change under change of chart? Let's say the one form, let's say the n form looks like that in one chart, namely the chart of coordinates x. How does it look like when we go to another chart of coordinates x tilde? Both charts cover the same region in the abstract manifold. Well, then we know that the dxi, the dx1, for example, will become the following. Dx1 by dx tilde I contracted with this. Okay? Because this is a covariant one vector, under change of chart, it will transform by picking up this Jacobian matrix times this basis vector. Similarly, this thing in the new coordinate system becomes that matrix contracted with this, and so on, until you have this Jacobian matrix contracted with that. This looks like a lot of terms, but there aren't really as many. Because whenever two of those terms are the same, for example, if this I1 is 1 and this I2 is 1, this thing is 0. This is only non-zero if it consists of a dx1, a dx2, a dx3, etc., up until dxn in an arbitrary sequence, all right, but each one of them just 1. Which is to say that you always get only one term over there. I mean, if it's not zero. Most of the terms are zero. And those that are not zero consist of this thing up to possibly a minus. Because it may not be dx1, dx2, dx3, dx4. It may be like this. 1, 3, 2, 4, 5. You can just use one minus sign and flip them around. So I can reorder all of those occurring terms such that I have dx1, dx2, dx3, dx4, etc. And when I reorder, I have to occasionally put a minus sign. It depends on how many times I have to reorder. In other words, it's the signature of the permutation that I need in order to get to dx1, veg, dx2, etc. up until dxn. But you see what happens there? We get the sum over all those terms where all of this simply boils down to this term with the dx1 to dxn and minus sign. If the permutation is odd, and the plus sign if the permutation is even. So we get the sum of all those matrix elements multiplied with a sign depending on whether this permutation that gets us from here to there is even or odd. But that just means that this becomes the determinant. See that? The sum of all those products with minus signs according to the signature of the permutation. So what we obtain is that the differential form in the new coordinate system can be written as vx tilde 1, that's vx tilde 2, after we've reordered everything, so that it has this sequence, multiplied with the determinant of this Jacobian matrix here, times the function evaluated at the same point. Let us compare this. Let us compare this expression here for the differential form in the new coordinate system to, See, we see that the integrand in the new coordinate system becomes the old integrand times the determinant of this Jacobian matrix, dx by dx tilde. Same thing here. The n form looks just the same, except that in the new coordinate, it has the determinant of the dx by dx tilde. This means the following. It means that the following definition for the integral of n forms is charge independent. Assume M is an oriented n-dimensional manifold. And assume that omega is an n form. Explicitly, in a coordinate system alpha, it might take this form. Then, let's assume that one chart suffices to cover the manifold. Then we define the integral of our n form omega over the manifold M to be calculable in this way. Simply take your chart. So all the points are being mapped into Rn. And then integrate with the usual Riemann-Lebesgue integration method your n-dimensional integral in this form. Take the integrand f of x and evaluate the usual way, where you integrate over the image of the manifold in Rn. So the critical thing is that this definition, as plausible as it may look, is quite non-trivial. Because it takes into account that the definition cannot depend on the chart that you use. So you could write down lots of things. But you have to keep in mind that whatever you define for the abstract manifold should not depend on the coordinate system that you use. Now, how do we know that the number that we calculate in this way, the outcome of this might be 5.7? You're given an abstract manifold, an abstract differential form on it, and you're to integrate this. Using a chart, you know how to do it, and you calculate the integral, and you find it's 5.7. Now somebody else comes along and says, yeah, but I don't like your chart. I use another chart, completely different chart. Then that other person will say, all right, I have my chart, I have a different f of x, and it will be a different f of x, because you know, it's a different coordinate system, it's a different function, and will it integrate it? How do we know it's going to get 5.7 as well? We know that because as we change coordinate from this coordinate system to this other guy's coordinate system, we can always view this as a change of coordinate from Rn here to the Rn of the other guy's coordinate system. And we know how that change of coordinates should work. Namely, you should pick up the Jacobian determinant. And that's what you do if you do it this way. Right? Because we know that as you change charge for an end form, the f of x will pick up exactly that Jacobian factor that you would also need on the representation side for the Rn. Yes, exactly. And it was important, and not only that, it had to be covariant. Because otherwise,
you would get not the right Jacobian, but the inverse. You would get the inverse determinant. But you need the actual determinant. So it had to be covariant and totally invariant. If one chart does not suffice to cover the entire manifold, then we simply piece it together. And we say, OK, integrate over one part of the manifold, and then integrate over another part. Make sure you don't integrate over the same part several times. And that is why we needed that the manifold is oriented. Because otherwise, the Jacobian could introduce minus signs from one chart to the other. But here we don't get it.
There are special n-forms. So just a second. What we defined now is an integral over n-form. And remember that we do not have to put any dx or something there. We are simply saying, here's the region that we want to integrate, namely m, or some domain of m, some piece of m, and here's a differential form. That's all we need to know. We don't need to know anything about coordinate systems. A differential form gets integrated over a piece or an entire manifold. And then if you choose a chart, this is how you evaluate it, or piece it together if you need several charts. And we have not said how we would integrate
n minus one forms, n minus two forms, and so on. You can only integrate n forms. Lower dimensional submanifolds can be integrated over forms of lower bounds,
as you will later see. Yes?
Because like a change of charts is a diffeomorphism, right?
Yes.
And so,
but it depends. If you take your function along with it, yes. Then it's the same thing. Then it's only a chart. The difference between active and passive.
So the integral is invariant under all the ones?
Oh, yes. There's a special kind of n forms, namely a set of n forms that are nowhere zero. They are called volume forms. Often they are also expected to be positive, but it depends on the required. They're called volume form, roughly speaking, because they could set a scale for volume. See, our manifolds, you should not really think of as having a shape. Our manifolds have holes or handles. That's something that is an invariant property, doesn't depend on coordinate systems. But you can't really say whether one of our manifolds has a particular shape or another particular shape. For example, if you have a manifold that is, let's say, in one coordinate system, you can think of it as being some sort of flying carpet. But you can also roll it up or deform it in some way. It's still the same thing. We have not given our manifolds any shape. They only have an overall topology. But what we can do now is we can give the manifold a notion of volume. And even that is totally ambiguous up until we define a volume form. For example, how would you define what is the overall volume of a piece of
our of an abstract manifold? If it's a piece of Rn, you know how to do this. But if it's a piece of an abstract manifold, then how do you define the volume of mass. There is no a priori way of doing it, because in principle you can map, let's say, a ball in R3. You can map that into a small ball in R3 and into a tiny ball in R3 in a completely different morphic way. So there is no notion of volume a priori to it. Our manifolds are only defined up to, you say, complete elasticity. If we want to give our manifold a notion of volume, we want to be able to tell for each chunk of it how much volume it has. We can introduce a volume form, which is simply an n form that is nowhere vanishing. Think of it as being a positive n form. Then you define the volume of a piece of the manifold as simply the integral over your volume form over that piece of the manifold. It can be shown that the existence of a volume form is a one-to-one correspondence to M being orientable. Again, I won't give you a proof for that. Finally, we get to the so-called boundary operator. I think I already introduced it, but here's the formal introduction. Assume that G is a region of our manifold, an open and connected subset of our n-dimensional manifold M. Then this region G has a boundary which is one which has one dimension left. So for example, a ball is three-dimensional, but its surface, the sphere, is two-dimensional. We denote the boundary of a region by del G. So del G is the boundary of the region G. And this del is also called the boundary operator. We will always want that our, we will always consider only cases in which the boundary is smooth. Which means that locally, if this big piece is our manifold, and this D is our region, I don't know why I called it D, it should be G. If G is our region in the manifold, then its boundary, marked in red here, is smooth if you can always take a piece of it and map it, a piece of the manifold like that, and map it into Rn with a chart, such that this boundary is just an n minus one dimensional plane in there. If you can always do this, then we say that the boundary is smooth. Here's the proposition. If the manifold is orientable, then also G is orientable, and in fact the orientation of M induces an orientation of G. Just clear, because if you have an atlas for M, it will induce an atlas for G. Finally, we are ready for one of the most beautiful theorems I know of, which is Stokes' theorem in its most general form. Let us assume that G is just you have to be a little bit careful to get the assumptions right. If G is a region in our manifold, let's say it's n-dimensional, and let's assume that its closure is compact. I hope you know these notions. If not, we can talk about it maybe after class. Then the following holds true. If omega is an n minus one form, and we integrate it over the boundary of the region, remember, G, the region, is n dimensional. So even if we wanted to, we cannot integrate omega over G. because omega is an n minus 1 form. Cannot be cannot be integrated over an n-dimensional space manifold. But it's an n minus 1 form that we can integrate over the boundary of an n-dimensional manifold, because the boundary is n minus 1 dimension. So this is the integral over of an n minus 1 form over an n minus 1 dimensional boundary of a region D. And that is then the same as if we integrated the exterior derivative of the n minus 1 form, which is an n form, over the full n dimensional region. And you see the beautiful duality here between the boundary operator here and the co-boundary operator over there. The reason why this is called the co-boundary operator is that under the Stokes theorem, you have a choice. You either take the co-boundary here, the boundary here, or the co-boundary over there.
On the left-hand side? You mean by the d omega?
What do you mean by that?
Well, do we not need...
Well, the manifold has to be oriented. And its boundary is then also oriented.
That's the orientation it's induced. And you wouldn't see the orientation occurring in here directly, because the orientation is something inherent to the atlas. What you see is that you can apply the same operation basically here or there, and it's either a boundary or co-boundary operation. It looks as if we could iterate this. You see, what we can do here is we can go from an n-dimensional space to an n-1-dimensional space, or from an n-1-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space, simply by going from an n-form to an n-1-form. Can we not iterate this and go from n-form to n-1-form to n-2-form to n-3-form and so on? Let's see. Let's try iterating Stokes. Let's assume that G, the region in question, is the boundary of another region H. Then what do we have? Well, then we have that by Stokes, the integral over H of d d omega, okay, is the integral over d omega of dH. So I got rid of a co-boundary operator at the expense of having a boundary operator over there. And here again, I'm getting rid of a co-boundary operator to go over to the right-hand side. I get rid of this D at the expense of having another boundary operator over here. But you see, all this is saying is that zero is zero. But for two completely different reasons that we now see are very deeply connected. Namely, here we get a zero simply because we have the boundary of a boundary. The boundary of the boundary of a region is always empty. Take any region, let's say this can, it has a boundary, its surface, but that surface doesn't have a boundary. And so that is vanishing because the set is empty. On the left-hand side, however, we have a zero because we have the D applied to D is zero, which is a purely algebraic property. You anti-symmetrize something that's already anti-symmetrized, and that gives you a zero. Remember, we did this in the calculation. And this is the reason why the Stokes theorem is linking homology, which is the business of finding out about angles and poles and boundaries, to cohomology, which is an algebraic business of looking at closed forms, modulo exact form. The Stokes theorem has many important special cases. One of them is simply the case where the manifold is R. We go back to calculus 1 here. And the region that we may consider in this big manifold is simply the open interval from A to B. Then what's the boundary of that interval? Well, that's simply the point A and B. This is one-dimensional. The boundary is a set of two points, which are zero dimensional. Then Stokes' theorem tells us that the integral over the full region, meaning the integral from A to B, of the exterior derivative of F, which is simply the derivative of F, is the integral of F over the boundary. So this is the regular integral. We integrate df by dx over the integral over the interval from A to B. So this is the integral from A to B of df by dx here. And on the right-hand side, we have f at the boundary, point A, point B. So this is f of B minus f of A. So this is simply that equation here, which is the fundamental theorem of vectors. Next special case. The manifold is two-dimensional. Our region is some domain that is two-dimensional. Let's say a disk. It has no boundary. So it has a boundary curve, BG, and it has no boundary. Now consider a one form. You see, we want to integrate something over the boundary of G. If G is a disk, its boundary is a circle. And if you want to integrate over a circle, which is one-dimensional, we can only integrate a one form over it. So let us look at the one form. A one form in R2 can always be written as some function times dx1 plus some function times dx2. More precisely, that's a zero form wedge a one form plus a zero form wedge a one form. We know that these are basis vectors, so we can always do that. Then what is d omega, the exterior derivative of that? For Stokes, we need both omega and d omega. Well, let's see, we have to differentiate. You see, we have to apply the exterior derivative on this and on that. What's the exterior derivative on this? Well, we used the last before. It's the exterior derivative on omega, vetch dx1 plus omega of x, exterior derivative of dx1. But of course, the exterior derivative of dx1 is zero because we would have dv x1. So all we are left with is the exterior derivative of omega 1 of x. And what is that? D omega 1 of x is d omega 1 by dx2, dx2 plus d omega 1 by dx1, dx1. But we already have a dx1. That would go away with the best product. So we are only left with this one term with a minus sign because of the way that these things arise, because you would have dx2 veg dx1. If we want to write it in this sequence, we have to have a minus sign. Similarly, we get that the exterior derivative of that gives us this. So this is the exterior derivative of omega. Then the Stokes theorem gives us this equation here, where I've simply put in what d omega is here and what omega is over there. And that you may know as Green's theorem. In fact, it is also the Cauchy integral formula. If you view the complex plane as R2, then this is the Cauchy integral formula. And the exactness of a differential form then translates into the Cauchy-Riemann equation holding true. If you're familiar with complex analysis, please try this out. It's very nice. Second special, third special case of applying the Stokes theorem. Let's say we work with R3. Now in R3, you may remember this equation here as the Stokes theorem from electrodynamics, for example. You would have a vector field, and then you take the so-called cross product with the so-called Nabla operator. and integrate that over a surface. And then that is supposed to be the same as the integral over the boundary of the surface of the vector field. And this is indeed a special case of Stokes' theorem, where the region A is what would be our region V here, and omega is a one form, and the cross product of Nabla with the one form is really simply the exterior derivative of the one form. Another special case that is going to be very important also for general relativity, Gauss's theorem. Oftentimes, Gauss's theorem is presented as separate from Stokes' theorem, but Gauss's theorem is really just a special case of Stokes as well. Let us assume we have chosen a volume form omega, some always positive n form. Then we can define a new kind of derivative, yet another one. And that is the divergence of a vector field. The divergence of a vector field with respect to volume form omega is given by this expression. Two things to keep in mind. First, the divergence of a vector field is only defined relative to a volume form. If you have not specified the volume form, you can't say what the divergence of a vector field is. And that's roughly because the divergence of a vector field does the following. A vector field has two components. I'm just giving you intuition. They don't really make you think more precise. A vector field, viewed as a flow of a liquid, for example, or a gas, let's say, has two properties. It has a rotational part to it, where stuff is just moving around, and it also has a divergence part to it, where new fluid is being produced, or fluid is being taken out of the system. Let's say you have a tiny, tiny straw, and it's attached to a pump, and it will actually pump out air from this room, let's say. Then you see that you have air molecules flowing towards that straw, or vice versa. If the straw pumps air into it, you have air flowing out of the opening of the straw, going in all directions. The vector field will show that, because you have, you know, vectors that point in all directions away from that point. If you have no such thing, no additional fluid, no fluid taken away, no fluid being compressed, no fluid expanded, then it's purely rotation. Now you may, now the rotation part can be picked up even without knowing about a volume form. However, if you want to know how much do we have compression, how much do we have expansion, or how much new material is being pumped in or out, then it can only be specified relative to volume form. Because remember, if you don't have a volume form, you don't have a sense of what is big and what is not. Because a diffeomorphism can map an arbitrarily large ball, for example, into an arbitrarily small ball. And similarly, a lot of pumping in can be mapped into just a tiny bit of pumping in or not. So the divergence is relative to a volume form, and it's defined in the following way. The divergence of a vector field with respect to the volume form is given by the Lie derivative of the vector field. And the Lie derivative of the volume with respect to the vector field. So you can view this as the change of the volume with respect to the vector field. Okay, and if we just have another minute, if we look at the divergence of the vector field with respect to the volume form, well, what is it? It is itself an n form, because the volume form is an n form. Its Lie derivative is also an n form, which means we can integrate it over n-dimensional manifold. Now remember what the Lie derivative was. The Lie derivative is the exterior derivative after the inner derivative plus the other way around. But since omega is already an n-form, we can forget about this piece, because V on an n-form would give us an n-plus-1 form. There is no such thing. So the divergence of a vector field is also given simply by this expression here. First evaluate the inner derivative of the volume form, and then the exterior derivative. But the fact that we have the exterior derivative here allows us to use Stokes' theorem. Because remember, we can always get rid of this, of a co-boundary operator, at the expense of having a boundary operator. So here, we have the integral over the divergence of a vector field. Okay, this is the integral over the divergence of a vector field, divergence being the inner derivative. And then we can say, okay, let's get rid of this co-boundary operator at the expense of having to introduce a boundary operator over here. So we're left with this. So if we take the divergence of a vector field over region G, we get the same value as if we calculated simply the inner derivative of the volume form in the direction of the vector field psi over the boundary of that region. So that means that the divergence over the region is given by the inner derivative of the volume form over the boundary of that region. And that, you may have seen before, maybe a little bit different formulation, is the Gauss theorem. Okay, I think we are totally out of time for today. I'm sorry that we went a few minutes over. Okay, are there any questions? Any questions in Guelph? All right, so we're done for today. See you on Thursday. Has everybody received an email now from me? You haven't?